Spirit Radio Podcasts. The best of the morning show with Wendy Grace.
Many of us will be familiar with the phrase, a dog is for life, not just for Christmas. Yet at this time of year, lots of puppies are bought and sadly in January have to be found new homes. We chatted to Kira Byrne of Dogs Trust while she explained to us why this isn't a great time of year to think about getting a puppy for your kids and gave advice to those who are thinking about getting a dog. What are the things they need to consider?
Well, first of all, Christmas is the worst time of year to think about taking on a dog. You know, regardless of where you're getting the dog from, Christmas is just notoriously a busy time. You know, there's going to be food around the house, there's going to be decorations. And also the time that you need, especially for if you're getting a young puppy, the time that you need to train that puppy to, you know, get him used to things in a normal fashion and not, you know, have them used to it being a madhouse where there's people, you know, coming and going all the time. So we would really say, we really, really strongly advise people to wait until the new year if you're thinking of getting a dog, whether you're buying one or you're adopting one. Please do wait until the new year.
So what's the kind of things that you should think about, you know, like any big decision in your life, that you should think, what are the things that we need to either, you know, things we need to have in our house or attitude we even need to have before we even, and even, you know, the financial, the cost of it, it costs money to have a dog or a cat to feed them, to look after them, to take them to the vet. What are the things people should think about?
Absolutely. I mean, a dog is, you know, potentially a 13-year commitment. That's the average lifetime of a dog. You know, and when you get a dog, there isn't just the food that you know, the obvious things you think about. You know, if your dog gets sick, you have to bring him to the vet. But there's also regular vet checkups that your dog will need, and vaccines. There's, you know, things for the dog to be, for training. There's a whole host of expenses that come with a dog, you know, his bed, his toys, you know. So, you know, there really is, over the course of a dog's lifetime, you can expect on average to pay up to 10,000 over the course of the dog's life for your dog. So we really, really strongly advise people to think about that. But I mean, money is only one aspect. There's another really big consideration that people need to have, and that is the time. You really need to have time for a dog. A dog needs to be walked every day. Dog needs to have, you know, someone, it needs company. You know, dogs don't like being left on their own. And that's usually what happens what we see when dogs, sometimes people call in to surrender the dog and they're like, oh, my dog is, you know, driving me mad. He's bored in the house all day on his own. But, you know, you really need to think about these things before you get a dog and think, am I going to have to leave the dog for the whole day while I'm out at work? Or is there someone that can pop in and, you know, pop in on the lunch break and bring him for a walk? Or, you know, will there be people coming and going so that he's not going to be left for 8 to 10 hours every day on his own?
Because no matter what size the dog is, Kira, it's fair to say that that's just not fair. If there's no one going to be in the house all day, leaving a dog cooped up inside is not fair on them.
Absolutely. It's really not fair. And there's a right time to get a dog. And when, you know, when you have the time, when you have the space, when you have the means to get a dog, that's when, you know, you need to really think about it long and hard and think about all the factors that could come into play. You know, even little things that might change in your life, like, are you planning on having a baby in a year? You need to prepare for that. You know, are you planning on moving house, or are you planning on, is your new landlord going to, you know, accept dogs into the premises? There's loads of factors that need to be just taken into consideration. A little bit of planning involved is what we're asking. Bit of research as well, researching the breed of dog that suits your lifestyle. It's really, really important. We can't stress that enough.
I remember going back to that time when my parents finally decided, okay, you can get the dog. We were trying to get a rescue dog and found this giant Labrador that a lady couldn't handle anymore, being dragged around the block. And it was a dog. I just wanted it. And my mum and dad had to say, you know, we don't have a big enough garden, all that sort of stuff. And a small King Charles was what worked for us in the end. But you're right. People just don't think about it. We want the instant gratification or whatever. But one of the big campaigns that you're running at the moment, Kira, is How Is That Doggy in the Window? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so this was a campaign that we launched last month, and we do launch campaigns every Christmas just to warn people of the dangers if rushing out to buy a dog, especially coming up to the festive period. So what the title of the campaign is How Is That Doggy in the Window? And really, the reason that we came up with that is because there's so many shop front windows now that breeders are able to use to sell dogs. So there's the internet, there's social media, and there's all the new age places that you would look to now. It's not the traditional pet shops anymore that sell dogs that we have to be careful of. So we want to really highlight the fact that there are so many new age shop fronts that they can use. And behind that, we want people to look behind that to see what is going on behind the scenes. Could this be an irresponsible breeder? There are plenty of great breeders out there.
So what should you be looking for, Ciara, then, if you are, and let's say Christmas is over, you've really thought about it, you've thought about the needs that you have, the type of dog that would suit. It's all too easy to go online and look at pictures of cute puppies and all that sort of stuff. But what are the kind of red flags that people should have their eyes open for?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the biggest things that we say is to meet the puppy more than once before you take it home. And I know you had mentioned that earlier. We had statistics around that, around how many people didn't actually meet their puppy before they went to take it home. So we would advise calling the breeder first and talking to them a little bit and asking them the relevant questions, to find out a little bit more about them. They will want to, a responsible breeder will want to know that the puppy is going to a really good home. So you'll kind of get a feeling, you know, and we would say, well, always follow your gut as well on things like this. If you think that a puppy is coming from a bad breeder or a puppy farm, to just follow your gut and don't take the dog, because even though you're saving that one dog, you're fueling the trade and there's plenty more dogs where they came from, unfortunately. And that's what we want to try and stop. So it's really just to get people thinking about the type of questions to ask. Is the puppy microchipped? Is the puppy vet checked? Is the puppy over 8 weeks old? Things like that.
The Best of the Morning Show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio.
Our prayer coach this week was Susan Heaney, and we were talking about the fact that waiting can be a really good thing and how Advent can be filled with not stress, but with faith, hope and love. So how do we do that? Well, the first thing Susan touched on was how waiting can be a good thing.
We're almost conditioned to think that waiting is a negative thing, that we shouldn't wait, that it needs to be quicker, that it needs to be instant. And if we're in a waiting space, it's a bad space to be in. Whereas Advent is really a waiting space that's a really good space to be in. And I think, you know, society, our shops and consumerism, I think, have conditioned us to kind of go straight from Halloween to Christmas, and with nothing in between. But actually, we have these 4 weeks of Advent, which are really, really precious time for waiting with God.
How do you make that shift then? Because it's hard not to feel the pressure. And gosh, yeah, I remember being in a shopping centre in early November and all the Christmas trees and everything were up. And even, certainly, I think something that has changed from when I was growing up, when I was a kid, that there is even pressure coming from kids to get the decorations up and everything up as early as possible. Mm-hmm. How do you kind of make an effort to really say, no, hang on, let's bring it back to that time of waiting and expectation?
Well, I think sometimes it can be really, really simple. I think you have to be intentional about it. I think you have to decide, I'm going to do this.
It's not going to happen by itself.
You know, because if you're going to wait, you have to decide to wait. So you have to stop what you're doing to wait. And, you know, I know people are busy and I know we have things to do and people are at work and they have families to look after. But it can be just something as simple as saying, I am going to do this once a week for the next 4 weeks. I'm going to set aside a time, maybe a Sunday afternoon when you're not at work. And, you know, this time of year, everything's getting darker. The nights are getting shorter. It's a dark time of year, and it's a time when we can actually focus on the fact that Jesus came at Christmas, that he's the light of the world. And so why not find a quiet space, sit down, light a candle, and let that be your time to wait with God. And just be intentional about doing it. And even if you only do that once a week for 4 weeks, you'll have done it four times that you wouldn't have done if you hadn't chosen to.
I know Red Cross Church has a fantastic tradition with kids and families. And how do we... It's hard enough, Susan, for us to be intentional for ourselves. I'm thinking of little things. Like I already mentioned the decoration. I certainly remember as a child just... It was 6 o'clock in the morning. I wanted to open the advent calendar to get the chocolate before I even have my breakfast. How do we instill that in our kids? And is there little things that we can do together as a family to make this advent season one of waiting and filled with hope and joy?
Well, I think actually one of the things that you can do is have that candle lighting time as a family. And we actually used to do this with our own children on a Sunday afternoon. We'd make a nice little Sunday tea. We'd bring it into the sitting room. We would then light the candle. We'd get one of those candles that can count down, but that you don't have to. We would be intentional about lighting the candle, remembering that we were waiting for Jesus to come, but also remembering that he's actually with us. And I think one of the things that we forget in Advent is, and I think, you know, everyone will get Advent calendars and we get the chocolate and we see Advent as a countdown to Christmas, whereas actually Advent is a season in its own right. And yes, it culminates in Christmas, but it's about so much more than Christmas.
What's it about for you?
For me, Advent is, it's recognising that Jesus has already come. I mean, I think when we think about Christmas, we're celebrating the birth of a baby. But in Advent, God wants us to remember that he's actually not a baby anymore. He has already come. The birth of Jesus has already happened. And at Christmas, we celebrate that. And we come to God with our lists of all the things that are wrong and all the things that are going on in our life, or all the prayers that we want to pray for other people. And sometimes he's actually saying, I just want you to sit with me and I want you to receive the things that I have for you. And so, Advent's a good time to do that.
I'm thinking of myself now, picturing myself sitting there trying to rest after the baby's gone down, light a candle, all that. Oh, I can see distraction coming in very quickly, Susan. What, you know, especially for those of us who, or people listening who, they're not used to that kind of quiet, prayerful meditation. Mm. It's really hard in a noisy world when we just have so much distraction. Would you recommend, you know, would you pray with the scripture? Would you just have a chat? Or where's a good place to just try and, you know, close your ears to all the competing things for your attention, basically?
Well, I mean, obviously, if you know the scriptures, then that's a good place. Do you know, like, so if you're sitting with God and you say, I really need your peace today, then, you know, go to Philippians 4, verse 7. The peace of God, which passes all understanding, will guard your heart and your mind in Christ Jesus. And read that and ask him for his peace. If you're not familiar with the scriptures, God understands whatever we say to him. And if you just sit with your candle and your coffee and say, God, I don't have any peace. I need your peace. That's all you have to say. And you don't have to sit for hours and hours and hours. You know, I think all of us can give 10 or 15 minutes and just, and the thing is, if we want something and are willing to receive it, then God will give it to us. Sometimes we don't have it because we don't ask.
The Best of the Morning Show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio.
If you're someone who enjoys a glass of wine with your dinner, or maybe you're the type of person that doesn't drink a lot, but when you do drink, you drink a few drinks, but you mightn't consider it a binge. Do you know exactly how much you're drinking, how many units you're meant to drink, and the impact that drinking alcohol can have on your health? Well, this is something that we talked to Professor Frank Murray about early on in the week. He's the chair of the Alcohol Health Alliance, and he started off just by telling us a little bit about Ireland and our relationship with alcohol.
Well, Ireland's one of the heaviest drinking countries in Europe. And it's worth just making a couple of points. First of all, one in two people in Ireland who drinks alcohol drinks in a harmful or hazardous way. In other words, they drink above what are considered low-risk levels.
And do they know that they're drinking in a hazardous way?
Well, many of them do, but most people don't. Most people underestimate the amount of alcohol they consume. They miscount the number of standard drinks there are in most of the drinks that people consume. For instance, a lot of people think there are, whom I see in the hospital or in the clinics, would say that they drink, four or five glasses of wine, and you ask them, they say, four or five units of wine, and you say, how much is that? And they say, it's a bottle of wine. So a bottle of wine is about seven or eight standard drinks rather than four or five. So there's quite an amount of underestimation of the number of units in the alcohol that people consume. And it's also worth saying there's no safe level of alcohol consumption. You mentioned the word safe level there. There's a low-risk level. The only safe level is none. And above that, we consider low-risk limits. And they're, in Ireland, 11 units for a woman and 17 units from man.
You see all these probably mythical articles, you know, Professor Murray, and it's interesting that you've highlighted that. Look, it's low risk. It's a risk carried with whatever amount of alcohol you drink. But, you know, obviously we used to have that those ads, I remember from years ago, about the iron and a Guinness a day and all that sort of stuff. And constantly seeing these things in tabloid newspapers about, oh, red wine is good for your heart and all that sort of stuff. Are we getting a lot of misinformation when it comes to alcohol?
The evidence in relation to the harms of alcohol have been greatly clarified in recent years, and we're much more confident about that. And there's, the benefits of alcohol from a health point of view have been greatly exaggerated. And I think the idea that you should take a drink to improve your health is a complete myth and should be completely avoided. So the idea that people might take a glass of wine several times a week to improve the health of their heart, there is no excuse for doing that, in my view. The disadvantages of consuming alcohol way overwhelm any minor improvement in cardiac outlook. And the reason for that is that, you know, the tumours in particular are increased in people who even drink relatively small amounts of alcohol, particularly breast cancer, which is something most women don't appreciate. Because the evidence, and the reason they don't appreciate that is not because they're being careless, it's because it's quite hard to find that information. And as you know, there are no warnings currently on alcohol beverages here in Ireland, although that's going to change shortly.
Tell me a little bit about that, just in terms of the increased risk. Let's take breast cancer that you mentioned there, Professor Murray.
Yeah.
What sort of levels would you need to drink to increase your risk?
Even drinking one standard drink a day, say a small glass of wine, is associated with a 10 or 11% increase in the risk of breast cancer. And it's estimated that in Ireland, about 1 in 8 breast cancers is due to alcohol. So if people didn't drink any alcohol in Ireland, it would be 1 in 8 less breast cancers, which is quite a lot when you think about that, isn't it? Because breast cancer is the commonest malignant tumour in women. So there are, you know, even at low levels of alcohol consumption, we see increased risks of various conditions, including cancer, and including, of course, incidents and accidents and having something on a night when you go out to drink.
Yeah, and just kind of alcohol-related injuries. In terms of just explaining the kind of low risk versus, because I think we have a huge issue when it comes to binge drinking. You know, you might talk to someone and say, oh, I don't drink from too often, but when I drink, I really drink. Or maybe people don't consider it a binge, but it actually is.
Yeah. Well, Ireland is in the top 2 or 3 in the world for binge drinking, where the country in the world, after in one of the rankings, we were second only to Austria for binge drinking. So Ireland has a terrible problem with binge drinking. And in fact, the point you make is quite a good one, that many people don't think what they're doing is a binge. That it's acceptable to, it's acceptable from a health or and well-being point of view and have a lot to drink. The international definitions of binge drinking are 5 or 6 standard drinks in an evening. So that's about 3 pints. Or just over half a bottle of wine. That's what would be considered a binge. And the reason why we're so concerned about people binge drinking is because up to 1/3 of the deaths associated with alcohol and many of the adverse outcomes associated with alcohol relate to the event of drinking. So it's not people drinking just, you know, over years. It's actually just going out and having a fair amount of alcohol to drink and then getting involved in an accident or an incident or a fight or a road incident, or perhaps becoming depressed and taking their own lives. So the actual event of drinking itself, irrespective of its long-term effects, has a substantial risk in terms of adverse outcome.
And in terms of the education piece then, do we have a lot of work to do there? And I think a lot of the things that you've touched on, whether it's the increased risk in breast cancer, but even thinking of our cultural attitude towards alcohol. I know myself, Professor Murray, I wouldn't call myself, I'm kind of an accidental pioneer. I just don't really drink a lot between kind of breastfeeding and being pregnant over the years. And when you go out and you say you're not drinking, people do kind of say, why? Are you sick? Is there something wrong with you?
Yes.
Or ask you if you're pregnant. You know, we do have this kind of cultural obsession with alcohol.
Well, alcohol is pervasive in Irish society. We live in an alcohol-saturated society. The point you make is absolutely right. And if you do go out, there's almost a sense of what's wrong with you if you're not consuming alcohol. So I do think we have adopted the wrong attitude to alcohol over time. And we see the consequences of that. Because of that unhealthy relationship we have with alcohol. We drink too much, both overall and in binges. And we have 1,000 deaths per year in Ireland and a $4 billion cost approximately to the Exchequer, which is a huge amount of money. So the personal cost to the drinker, the cost, the harm to other people in his life, such as his family and friends, and the cost to society, are all very high and reflect that culture of drinking on almost every occasion in Ireland.
The Best of the Morning Show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio.
Independent TD Carol Nolan joined us earlier on in the week. She was one of the 15 TDs who voted against abortion legislation this week in the Dáil. She shared with us a little bit of her experience during the process.
To sum it up, it was frustrating and heartbreaking. They'd be the two words I'd use to describe the whole experience and indeed the whole ordeal. We proposed a number of very humane and reasonable amendments. You know, we're hearing about democracy all of the time and the need to listen to other views, but that was far from the case. And I have to say, as an Irish politician and indeed as an Irish woman, I'm ashamed. And anybody could see for themselves, indeed with the exchanges that took place on a very regular basis, that there was hardly any part of the debate civilised. I don't believe there was any part indeed civilised in regard to this debate. We put forward very humane amendments. We were very reasonable. The minister just did not want to listen. Our view wasn't the same view as his, so we were just shot down on each occasion. And indeed there was outbursts of aggression and insults and name calling and all of the rest of it. But I feel myself it's absolutely shameful. I mean, we're all legislators in there, and while we hold different views, we're entitled to articulate those views and indeed make legislation better. That's the democracy, you know, and the whole democratic thing to do is to try and ensure that the legislation going forward is done properly. And with this abortion bill, I mean, it is extreme, it is harsh, it's unnecessarily harsh, and it is over the top. And I've made those comments to the minister last night.
Were you surprised, Carol, throughout the process? And people might have been following the Oireachtas Health Committee and now to the Dáil just. And I think for anybody, if they did watch, you know, even a short bit of those discussions, the attitude did certainly at times to be even, one could describe it as petulant. But were you surprised that some of your amendments were not met with any kind of real kind of proper discussion? Or did you expect that they would all be shot down?
No, I was shocked. I mean, I thought, in all honesty, that these were very, reasonable amendments. We had the whole notification amendment concerning minors, and there's only notification in terms of a minor and the parent being contacted in guidelines only. Now, I feel that this is such a serious issue. And indeed, you know, for any minor to find herself pregnant, of course she needs the support of her parents. And I felt that notification one definitely should have been accepted. As, you know, the conscientious objection, I would say the same thing for that. Also, conscientious objection for our GPs, our pharmacists, our midwives and nurses and other healthcare workers. Conscientious objection is a fundamental human right. And yet we see the Irish Parliament has turned its back on that right and ignored those people. And I just feel that that's a disgrace, that in the Ireland of 2018, you know, there's much talk of this new republic. But yet what they've done is they've ostracised people, they've sidelined people, they've shut them down. We've seen that, of course, with the GPs, Minister Harris's refusal to meet GPs, and indeed the first time GPs heard that the abortion services would be led or expected to be led by them was when they heard on the radio. I mean, you know, it's just ridiculous. And I just feel that, you know, there hasn't been fair play here. And I do feel that the government will rue the day, and indeed all of those who jumped up and down trying to get this extreme and over-the-top legislation through. I feel, you know, we were looking at international...
How do you feel, Carol, about the point? And it is, I suppose, something that the Health Minister and indeed many others in Fine Gael certainly kept saying, look, the people have voted, we don't need to be discussing it again, you know, the people have spoken on this issue. How did you feel about that defence?
But the people didn't speak on the legislation, and that was our whole point. I mean, we went in and genuinely did our best to try and make government listen, and indeed those other TDs who were on the other side of debate. We respected that. But people did not vote on Simon Harris's legislation. They did not vote for children with disabilities not to have the right to protection. They did not vote in terms of the taxpayer funding abortions to the tune of 12 million as a start. They did not vote on those issues. People simply voted to repeal the 8th Amendment. They had the choice whether to retain the 8th Amendment, as we know, or repeal it. They voted to repeal. They did not vote on the legislation. Therefore, for the government and indeed any TD on the pro-choice side to be saying that people voted on this, that's incorrect, completely incorrect and indeed misleading.
Were you surprised, Carol, that there were, I mean, I know there was 12 abstentions, but just 15 votes against. Were you surprised there wasn't more support, especially from, for example, Fianna Fáil, who'd been given a free vote on the issue?
Yes, I was very disappointed with the Fianna Fáil TDs, given that they're grassroots and indeed at their Ardesh, that, you know, they came out with a pro-life stance and advocated for that. It was disappointing to see, you know, that only four Fianna Fáil TDs actually voted against the legislation last night. And I hope that the public do realise this, because what I hope won't happen is for many Fianna Fáil TDs to stand on doorsteps come election time and tell people they're pro-life. That certainly wasn't the indication last night at all. Only four, as I say, voted against the legislation. It was very disappointing, because when we go back to before the referendum in March, there was 32 TDs that voted against the, you know, the holding of the referendum, because they had genuine concerns, like myself, were pro-life. And yet we only see four out of over 20 that would have voted and would have claimed to have been pro-life now voting against the legislation. And as I say, this is an extreme bill. So I would have expected those TDs to step up. I would have expected them to represent their membership and represent what happened at the Ardesh. And indeed, the fact that they had a free vote, it shows that there was absolutely no excuse for them.
The Best of the Morning Show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio.
Earlier on this week, it was announced that there's going to be a referendum on divorce. Two things that the referendum will look at. One is lowering the amount of years needed before you can actually have a divorce from 4 years to 2 years. And the other thing is taking the reference to marriage and its importance out of the Constitution. We chatted to psychiatry professor Patricia Casey about her thoughts on this earlier on in the week. And one of the things we started talking about was, would this referendum afford us the opportunity to have a broader discussion on how we can actually support families when they are struggling, when they are in need of perhaps counselling and other things that might actually help their marriage survive? Will we actually end up talking about those things as well?
Indeed, one would hope that would be discussed in the course of the referendum, but given the track record this government has of referendums and how they're conducted, I doubt that that will happen, unfortunately. But I think that's why the two-year wait is important, that it will afford people the opportunity to seek help for their marriage, to seek ways of mending it, if that is within the bounds of possibility. I mean, thankfully, we have a relatively low divorce rate, and I think because many people do seek help for their marriages when they seem to be in difficulty, and the help they're getting would ostensibly seem to be beneficial. So I think that should continue, and that's why I think anything less than 2 years would concern me, that people might at the first sign of troubles in a marriage or the first breakup might then head for the divorce court straight away, rather than trying to repair it and rebuild the marriage again. I hope that discussion will take place, but as I said, I am not very, very optimistic.
You're not hopeful for that. In this discussion, I would imagine much of it will focus on the adults in this relationship, but of course in many marriages there are children too.
Yes.
I'm sure through your work over the years you've probably seen the impact that divorce can have on children, and that probably needs to form part of the discussion as well.
Oh, indeed. I mean, I deal with adults, but when children grow up and become adults, marital breakdown can have a significant impact, huge impact, in fact, particularly when they lose touch with their parents. As a significant number do lose touch with one of the parents, usually the father. And fathers have great difficulty maintaining access, because divorces can become very acrimonious. Even in no-fault jurisdictions like we have here, that means that people can get a divorce without blame being apportioned, unlike the UK, where they have fault-based divorce, where people, you know, it could be divorce on the grounds of unreasonable behaviour or some other ground that doesn't apply in Ireland. No grounds need to be provided, but notwithstanding that, divorces still become acrimonious, and fathers particularly, and grandparents, we mustn't forget the importance of grandparents as well, do become estranged from their children and grandchildren simply through often just malevolence on the part of the other party.
Yeah, and that is something that needs to be discussed and looked
at. And that has an effect then on children. As children, their schooling suffers, they become disruptive at school, they don't perform as well. And then as adults, it can affect their relationships and how they view relationships, and they view relationships with mistrust, and often will be reluctant to get married because they don't want to see that marriage breaking down as that of their parents did. So it does have knock-on effects. And I think the motif should be that we should try and build strong marriages. That should be the motif, principal motif, rather than break up marriages.
Yeah, and ask how can we do that and how can we better support that as a society. Well, that leads me to my next question then, because the other part of this referendum, Patricia, as you touched on, was taking marriage out of the constitution. How do you feel about this part of the proposal?
Well, I'm totally opposed to this part of the proposal. I think marriage is an important institution, and the constitution recognises institutions, and I think this is one that should remain in the constitution. I think more importantly, if it does go back to the is taken out and it's left up to the Oireachtas completely, I think we will see extremely liberal divorce within a few years. We've seen what happened with the abortion legislation. It's even more liberal than they suggested it was going to be when people voted on it. And I think the same will happen, that gradually marriage will be eroded and people will come to the position of saying, oh, marriage doesn't matter. You know, a couple can live together or get married. It doesn't actually matter. We'll just take this out of the constitution. It has no place there. I can see the headlines, you know, old fashioned, you know, De Valera, 1950s, all of those kinds of canards will be raised. But I think it would be disastrous, because ultimately, a few years down the road, the law they enact after the referendum would be changed, and we might have a waiting time of 3 months or something crazy like that.
Yeah, maybe Patricia, I know you're not hopeful, but perhaps part of the discussion will be on that. I mean, in another referendum a number of years ago, a lot of the discussion was how important marriage was, you know, how important it was to people, all that sort of stuff. And as you say, that could very quickly, that dialogue very quickly change. Do we need to bring it back to just the positive impact that strong marriages have on culture? And when marriage is strong and family is strong, so too is society.
Yes, and indeed in cultures like the US now, the divorce rate is dropping again for the first time in decades. So perhaps, you know, other countries are seeing or having a different perspective on these kinds of issues than we have at the moment. And maybe that insight from the US will permeate here in due course. Time will tell.
The Best of the Morning Show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio.
Cleanas Foundation is a charity that assists families with practical things when their children are very, very sick in hospital. Things that we mightn't even think about unless we were in that situation ourselves, like having to travel to children's hospitals to and from Dublin, the cost of parking, hotel stays, food, having to give up your job. Well, we chatted to Brendan Ring, who is involved, the co-founder of Cleanas Foundation, and he started off just telling us a little bit about his daughter, Cleanas.
And we had two children, Cleanna and Colm. And Cleanna was our only daughter. And in 1998, when she was just 7 going on 8, she went to school on a Friday morning. And when she came home in the evening, she had a mark underneath her eye. And Terry, her mom, asked her what had happened. And she said that she'd bumped into the blackboard leaving school. And we were concerned, or Terry was concerned at the time. We brought it to our local GP, and he obviously suspected something was wrong with Cleanna, so he sent us directly here to the Limerick University Hospital at the time to have her checked on. I was at work at the time and quite busy, and later on that evening I got a call from Terry. She felt maybe it was necessary for me to come in that they weren't entirely happy with Pliana. So that was a Friday evening. It all happened very, very quickly. And we arrived in there. We stayed overnight with Pliana at the time. And next morning, we met one of the consultants in Limerick and a lady consultant. And she said, look, we have to move Pliana to Cork. We suspect that she has a brain tumour. So that was the beginning of our journey with Pliana, being told that she had a suspected brain tumour, and we travelled by car, even though they wanted us to go by ambulance. We travelled by car because we didn't want to upset her, because, as I said, she was only seven. And we arrived in Cork, and unfortunately, on Sunday morning, after more scans during Saturday and Saturday night, it was confirmed that she had an inoperable brain tumour. So that was Pliana, and
so what happened after you got this news? Obviously, I imagine, Brendan, you probably felt like your world was kind of crumbling around you, but then you're thinking of your beautiful little girl who's just seven, trying to be strong for her. It was inoperable, so was there any treatment path for Pliana at that time?
Right then, no. It was a low-grade astrocytoma. Surgery was ruled out completely because of the location of the tumour. So between the end of November and all this month of December, we had to decide what to do and do different conversations and meetings. Pliana went down the route of having to have oncology chemotherapy in Dublin, in Crumlin Children's Hospital.
And what was that like for her at that time and for you as a family? Because, you know, I guess people don't often think of just some of the practical things. There's the treatment that the child is having, which is very difficult in and of itself. But then there's practical things like having to travel, in your case, from Limerick up and down to Crumlin. Food there, where did you stay? How did all that sort of thing work, Brendan?
Well, it was all very sudden, as I said, and very difficult. And you're right, there is some superb treatment for our children, particularly in Temple Street and in Crumlin. But a huge problem besides Tina's illness, and she was fantastic. I mean, she kept us going. Her bravery was unbelievable. How she dealt with her illness, I just couldn't describe it. But on the practical terms, financially, in relation to being able to travel with Tina, because her protocol in Dublin, it was supposed to be 12 months, but it got extended to 18 months because there were times we arrived there with Pliana and she just couldn't have a treatment because she was neutropenic, her bloods weren't right and so forth. So we spent an awful lot of time literally moving from Dublin to Limerick on an ongoing basis for a year and a half. And there was a huge amount of cost in relation to car parking, the cost of travelling to Dublin itself, whether it was by car or by train, staying overnight in Dublin on lots of occasions. All the costs were building up. Terry had to take time out of her job. She actually stopped working at that time. So we quickly realised, you know, that, you know, there was a huge financial struggle as well as having the whole trauma of dealing with Pliana. And obviously with a child at home as well at the time, Colm, who was literally dropped there on his own, and we had to just pass him on to family members to try and look after him while we were away taking care of Pliana at the time, you know. And Pliana's illness, unfortunately, you know, even though we did lose Pliana and our anniversary was just last Sunday, we had 8 years of being with her, and not just alone being going to Dublin, but she spent quite a lot of time in Cork at the end of her life. Actually, we spent 4 months with her in a coma as such. Pliana was in a coma, living in Cork, again, racking up a huge amount of costs in relation to being with her, being beside her bedside all the time. And that just went on for 8 years. It's very difficult, and that's why we have Pliana's Foundation now, because we fully realise that right now, even today, there are thousands of children and parents that have to continuously travel around the country to hospitals getting their children looked after, and everybody's forgetting about the one major thing. Yes, they will be taken care of beautifully by our hospitals, but there's a huge cost involved in just parking and staying over and fuel cost and everything else that goes with that.
It is devastating to think of a family not being able to afford to be by their sick child's bedside, but as you say, you have to be in that situation to fully understand it.
Well, we have a very simple process in relation to people applying for funding from Pliana Foundation, because a lot of the families we deal with, unfortunately, children die very soon after being diagnosed with a serious illness, babies and so forth. We were blessed in the sense that we, you know, Pliana was spared for almost 8 years, but we're conscious that there are families that get news and they literally have weeks, months, and definitely a lot of cases, over 400 cases, less than 1 year. So we've got to be able to fund them straight away. So we do that very speedily if we have the funding, and that's the challenge. But look, as late as yesterday, we received letters in the post from families, and you know they're just heart-wrenching to really read them, and when you feel for what this funding means to them to be able to enjoy Christmas, for instance, with their children and with their other siblings. And we're conscious too that most families have other siblings, and we call those the shadow children, that they're being ignored and not looked after because there's somebody seriously sick, just like Cliona. So our funding is able to make somebody's Christmas, as enjoyable as possible.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.